From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. Welcome, Anita and Steve.
Always a pleasure.
Likewise, always a pleasure.
Well, here are the issues. In his first State of the Union address, U.S. President Joe Biden condemned Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine and rallied bipartisan support for the country. He addressed rising inflation that's hampering economic recovery, a future with COVID-19, and he outlined a unity agenda that he said could garner bipartisan support in Congress. President Biden's announcement that the U.S. would go after Russian oligarchs and close U.S. airspace to Russian planes in response to the invasion of Ukraine drew praise from Democratic lawmakers, but Republicans said the actions came too late. President Biden's Supreme Court pick, Ketanji Brown Jackson, is expected to be confirmed by the mid-April recess and stands a good chance of picking up bipartisan support to become the first Black woman to serve on the high court. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Anita, President Biden devoted a good 20% of his State of the Union speech to condemnations of Vladimir Putin's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine and praise for the fearlessness of Ukrainians. Did he deliver a strong message to Putin?
Well, let's start with the fact that he not only delivered about 11 minutes of rebukes against Vladimir Putin, he also did it at the very top of his hour-long State of the Union speech, which is to say that the President of the United States began his State of the Union speech by talking about another country. And for that, he was, we could say, rewarded by bipartisan rounds of applause and standing ovations. It seems to be almost unanimous that Republicans and Democrats alike think that the U.S. should take a strong stance against Russia. But it's very relative, and it's a difference of scale here. As you mentioned, Republicans wish that Biden had been a bit more hawkish and acted sooner and more forcefully, which he hasn't. He's ratcheted up these sanctions quite slowly, in their opinion. So he did get some very visible support on Tuesday night when he delivered these very scathing remarks in the chamber. But it remains to be seen how that's going to play out as things go forward in this very disturbing, upsetting conflict where we now see that 1 million people have fled Ukraine, a country of 40 million people. That's about the population of California, our most populous state in the United States. So it's very disturbing. And I think that it remains to be seen how much this will expose the political divides in America and how this will be politically weaponized as we embark on the midterm elections, which are coming up in just a matter of months. They'll be here tomorrow, it feels like.
Anita noted that Biden received bipartisan support and applause from members of Congress for what he had to say on Ukraine. While there's still some disagreements about various different policies and actual sanctions that need to be put on, there is basically a lot of support for what Biden has done as far as Ukraine is concerned. And Biden ran for president on the promise that he would be better at handling multiple crises than former President Trump. And after 13 months in office, he delivered that speech at a point where his political popularity is about as low as Trump's was during his presidency. Biden really needed this speech to try to reposition himself and Democrats ahead of congressional elections come November. And by leading his speech with Ukraine, by being pretty forceful in his condemnation of Putin and what Russia has been doing and explaining what the sanctions are supposed to do, I think Biden gains some hand here as far as how he is going to be seen as a leader here in the United States.
And if I may jump in on one thing, I was just searching through the speech and he used the word build 19 times in this hour-long address, but he very notably did not stray into very contentious territory by naming his Build Back better proposed bill. This is the enormous, you know, $1.75 trillion bill that has basically sputtered and died in Congress so far. So he was really careful in this speech to not cross any partisan lines. He just didn't bring up a lot of this very contentious legislation that he's proposing because he wanted to build consensus. And that's how he's kind of positioned himself, as a leader who builds consensus, who strives for unity. And in that way, I guess you could say he was successful on Tuesday night in having a pretty tame, overall warm reception to this speech.
Building on what Anita just said, Biden kind of used the build and better, but not build back better. But in his laundry list of various different domestic policy goals that he wants, he kind of broke down that build back better legislation to highlight the very popular, the kind of policy goals that get 60%, 70% support in various different polls, such as reducing the cost of prescription drugs, such as more and better early child care and pre-kindergarten for 4 and 5 year old children. So Biden really tried to find those issues that build consensus, that build some sort of bipartisanship, because he knows he needs that in order to pass any kind of legislation that's going to make any kind of impression and help Democrats come November, when members of Congress, all the members of the House of Representatives, and 1/3 of the Senate face voters.
Yes, that's very good points that you all have brought up with the president. He's rebranded his domestic agenda as Building a Better America. But what is reaction from Congress? How do you think that is going to be accepted?
I think Biden went even a step further as far as that is concerned to try and turn around that phrase of defund the police, which Republicans used in 2020 to paint Democrats soft on crime. Biden forcefully chanted fund the police to stem that rising tide of violent crime in the country. So he's not going to get Republican votes on very controversial issues. But what I think he has done is lay the groundwork for finding those areas where there can be consensus. And you mentioned in setting it up, Kim, that Biden wanted to create a unity agenda. And I found what he laid out as far as those policies that get kind of uniform acceptance by Americans, such as stopping the opioid crisis, more and better medical services for war veterans, those kind of things, and Biden putting them out there, as Anita said, he's trying to find those areas of consensus where he can work within those margins and get something done.
And it's notable that, you know, two members of the chamber that we saw very visibly on Tuesday night, I'm talking about Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, it almost feels like they'll oppose anything Joe Biden says. If Joe Biden says the sky is blue, Lauren Boebert will say, no, it's green. So he can count on this continued pushback from a certain part of the Republican Party. But what it looks like his strategy is to try to chip away at kind of the people in the Republican Party who are amenable to coming around, who can be persuaded. But it's hard to say because this is an election year and anything can happen and any issue can become politicized and become a political football in an election year, especially this election year.
Also, in the president's State of the Union address, he talked about COVID-19 and how it no longer need to control our lives in this new moment we're in, with the White House unveiling a plan for fighting COVID-19 in its new phase. The virus has now moved from a crisis to a lower level risk that does not dominate daily life. So given this new phase we're now in with COVID-19, do you all think that people are confident that the virus is now under control, and are they confident in the president's new strategy?
That's a really good question. A recent poll that I just saw showed most Americans do not feel that COVID is under control. That said, I think what Biden is trying to do is, you know, going back to our conversation, is depoliticize the issue of the pandemic, because You know, the issues of masks and masks in schools has divided the country along Republican versus Democratic lines. And I think Biden is trying to find that sweet spot right from the top at the White House, saying that we're moving to a new phase, signals that let's try and get this major issue out of the political realm and into the health realm. And I think that's his goal, to try and unify the country around something that where we're moving past what we've already gone through.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think everybody knows and everybody agrees on one thing, which is that we all hate this pandemic. I try not to use that word hate, but I think in this instance, I think the pandemic definitely deserves all of our hatred and our disgust. And I think Biden's channeling that, and the White House is definitely channeling that and using that as a way to build consensus. What was notable, I thought, in this speech was that if you contrast it with his joint address to Congress last year, there were no masks in the crowd because the DC mask mandate has expired and expired on that day. You know, if you spend enough time in DC, you probably do not think that was accidental. That seemed very coincidental that the masks came off just as the president was announcing a new phase in our fight against this horrible pandemic. So I think they are trying to reframe it, as Steve said, as an issue that we can all get behind and also something that has now entered a new phase.
Yes, absolutely. And wanted to get our next topics in. Looking at the UN General Assembly, they voted an emergency special session to demand an immediate halt to Moscow's offensive against Ukraine and withdrawal of all Russian troops. How do they think that Putin is going to respond to this demand, given what we're seeing?
I can answer that. I don't think he will respond in the way that they're seeking. I think that's pretty clear. I mean, look at all of the pressure that Western nations and the UN have put on Putin, and he has not responded to them. These waves of sanctions, crippling sanctions, including sanctions against him personally, against his foreign minister personally, and he hasn't stopped. So is a UN vote going to change his mind? Probably not. What's also notable is that there were, of course, five no votes, and these were, of course, Russia, Belarus, North Korea, Syria, and Eritrea. But perhaps more consequentially, there were 35 abstentions, which include members of the BRICS bloc. That's the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa bloc. Brazil actually voted in favor of the resolution, but the other members of the bloc kind of abstained and in a way sort of are treading that line of supposed neutrality in this issue. So what Putin can read from this is that 141 countries are opposed to him, but these are the usual suspects. These are the countries that have been pretty clear, and it's part of their policy to oppose this kind of thing. And that actually 40 countries exactly, including Russia, are kind of either on his side or in the middle. And that is meaningful.
The abstention by China comes after China voted no, along with Russia, for a similar resolution in the Security Council. And so member nations just bounced this resolution out to the General Assembly, which has less of an impact than a Security Council resolution, but nonetheless is still there. I think what we're going to see over the next several weeks and months as this plays out is, what is China going to do?
Meanwhile, Russian forces continue to shell multiple Ukrainian cities, while Russian officials said they were ready for another round of talks with Ukraine. What will be the status of talks?
That's a very good question. As we know, the first round of talks didn't yield any changes. I think the most we can hope for with this round of talks is that they don't lead to further escalation. But this seems to be a pretty difficult, tense situation. I don't want to predict the outcome of these talks, because I suppose if you want to be optimistic, we could reach a ceasefire. But I don't see either of these sides kind of giving up or ceding any ground.
Agree. I don't see Russia stopping. There's no reason for it to stop its invasion and its aggression. One thing that I heard in the coverage over the last several days that kind of stuck with me, and it was a report from a CNN correspondent in Moscow. And he finished his live shot by saying, Apple Pay is not working in Russia. That is the tip of where the economic sanctions are aimed to hurt, at the Russian people, making it more complex, more inconvenient for the simple chore of transacting business. It takes a while for economic sanctions to land, and it took longer in a pre-digital society. Perhaps with the speed that a digital economy creates may work its way through the Russian population as far as discontent a lot quicker than traditional economic sanctions might. But I think that's something to be watching for, is the reaction of the Russian people to what is happening. They're being dished out a whole bunch of disinformation. Voice of America and other outlets are trying to penetrate that and deliver reliable, accurate news and information to not just the Russians, but Ukrainians and elsewhere. So I think that's where a lot of eyes are looking. How long will Russian people put up with this?
If I may just interject with something that Steve brought up, the Russian Telecommunications Authority informed VOA that it was going to restrict access to our Russian language website. And VOA responded that we're not going to be able to comply with that. Because as Steve said, all we're trying to do really is to give our audience in Russia, Ukraine, and beyond a kind of a clear-eyed objective view of what's happening in this conflict. And in cases of conflict, I think our responsibility to provide public safety information, to say, for example, this city is under shelling, you know, that's important public safety information that people need to know so they can avoid going to such and such city. So that's what we're trying to do. That's what I know that we're trying to do in my beat at the White House, just provide objective information about what the decision makers are doing. And so I think that is worrying, because that's one less source of objective information that our audiences can access.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you all brought that point up. Let's just stop now for a quick break. And then when we come back, we'll continue a little bit more on the discussion of the Russia-Ukraine crisis. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. I wanted to just follow up with a focus on Ukraine's president. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, he vowed that Russia would not topple his government by pummeling Ukraine's cities and civilians with missiles. World reaction has been supportive of him. Is Russia surprised by the strength of Ukraine's president and the people of Ukraine?
If I were Russia, I would be surprised. It has been something for the rest of the world to see and admire how the Ukrainians are holding up against the Russian military, which, as everybody will acknowledge, is an overwhelming force against what Ukraine has, despite being heavily armed by the West. So I think that the Ukrainian spirit is certainly spreading throughout the world, and it is also raising the awareness that this is such an unfair and unbalanced kind of attack. I think that President Zelensky and his people are putting up a truly brave fight in what they're facing.
But I do wonder how long it's going to take before we realize that this is a very, very unfair fight. This is the Russian army versus a volunteer cobbled together group of teenagers and grandparents. And I say that because the age for the Ukrainian Armed Forces enlistment is now 18 to 60. So we have 60-year-olds on the front lines. And if you believe for half a second that anybody who's 17, 16, or 15 is holding back in this fight, I'd like to sell you a bridge somewhere in New Jersey. This is a civilian army largely defending itself against the fifth largest military in the world. And no amount of defiance on behalf of the Ukrainian people can counter that basic fact that this is a very unbalanced conflict.
And so far, neither the United States nor the NATO alliance are willing to put boots on the ground or even airplanes over Ukraine to try and protect it. The idea of a no-fly zone, such as there was in Iraq during the Iraq War, the no-fly zone has been shot down by members of the U.S. Congress as far as the U.S. enforcing such a no-fly zone. It doesn't seem that there's any appetite for United Nations type of enforcement of a no-fly zone. It's going to be a true eye-opening experience to see how long Ukraine can hold out before either it crumbles or assistance comes.
And, you know, sometimes in the middle of the night when I wonder about this conflict, I find myself going into a deep internet hole. And so last night I was reading about the START Treaty of 2011, signed by the United States and Russia, which basically controls the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles that each side is allowed to have. And I noted with some alarm that the treaty expires in 2026. And that either side can withdraw from this treaty for cause, and that very alarmingly, Russia has agreed to limit the missiles that it has that can reach the continental United States in 30 minutes. And so anyone who wonders why the U.S. is maybe moving very slowly and by some perspectives dragging its feet on this needs to remember that the nuclear deterrent is a big, big, big reason for that. You do not want two nuclear superpowers facing off over Ukraine. That is bad for everybody.
Good point. And just wanted to get this one last thought in before we go to our last topic. President Zelensky, he made an emotional appeal to the EU to fast track its membership application, saying this is no time to be neutral. Now, the EU has shown significant sympathy for Ukraine, but will it lead to a quick membership?
I don't think so. And the reason is the same as why Ukraine's membership in NATO will take some time. There are essential reforms that need to be made, both to the military and the economy of Ukraine, before it can be considered a full member of this alliance. And here's the other important thing about this alliance, both of these alliances. Article 5 and Article 42 are basically similar between NATO and the EU, and that is the collective defense agreement, that if Ukraine becomes a member of the EU today, while under attack by Russia, then every EU member is obliged under Article 42 to defend Ukraine as if it were an attack upon itself. Article 5 under NATO is the same principle. And so that would basically immediately draw all of these other countries into this conflict, which is something that I think the major powers would like to avoid. We don't want this to become World War III.
And by attacking Ukraine, the way it is attacking Ukraine, Russia is setting back and degrading the opportunity for Ukraine and setting it back years to join either NATO or the European Union.
I wanted to switch quickly now to our last topic. President Biden's Supreme Court pick, Ketanji Brown Jackson, is expected to be confirmed by the mid-April recess and stands a good chance of picking up bipartisan support to become the first Black woman to serve on the high court. Given this, what do you see in terms of opposition?
Ted Cruz is who I see in terms of opposition. He has already said that her nomination, or rather that Biden's choice to nominate a Black woman, is outrageous and offensive. And so I expect him to keep up with that drumbeat during her confirmation hearing. But he's up against some opposition within his own party, because she has been in recent days endorsed by big Republican legal scholars who have said, you know, she's fair, she's qualified, she is a good pick.
I don't expect Republicans to conduct a scorched earth campaign. There will be some opposition, and perhaps more than just some. The Republicans and conservatives will continue to have a comfortable 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court if and when Judge Jackson is confirmed. She won 3 Republican votes last year when she went through a Senate confirmation to be a federal appeals judge. Even if those 3 Republicans don't vote for her, and one of them has already come out, Lindsey Graham, not so much against her pick, but much more for someone else, Democrats still own the tie-breaking vote in the evenly split Senate. So no matter what happens, unless something drastic happens within the Senate where a member or two die, then I see her moving toward getting confirmed to the Supreme Court sometime in mid-spring.
Thank you, and we will have to end the show on that note. My thanks to our panelists, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.